Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. This is part two of our conversation with Camilo Gomez on the state of Latin America.
Yeah, in general, I don't see necessarily that the Latin American church is necessarily too much to the left. And so yeah, more or less, I agree with you.
So do you think that perception has a little bit to do with the diaspora communities of various Latin American countries, particularly Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua? So really Central American in the United States, because, you know, the only largely ethnic conservative force in the U.S. is, I don't mean to overly generalize, but it's generally, you know, is Cuban. So
yeah,
and maybe Venezuelan, actually.
Yeah, now maybe Venezuelans.
Although even Venezuelans tend to be Democrats.
Yeah, funny enough, it's not even the Peruvians that escaped the shining path. there are Peruvians that are registered in the Democratic Party and quite active in progressive politics, which could sound weird because but yeah, I mean, not even the shining path moving them to the right.
Well, I think it has a little bit to do, honestly, with the racial politics in America being what they are, and they've changed. So one of the things I've been fascinated by, when I was a kid in the South, for most people, Latinx were considered pretty close to white. That's not true anymore. And it was because the South in particular had a binary, like, race schema, like you were white or you were black and that was it. Like, literally, like, when I was in middle school and high school, they still counted, like, they did demographic counts, and they only counted white and black. And they didn't ask you. It wasn't self-reporting. They would just count the white kids and count the black kids, and that would be it. They don't do that anymore. But and I'm not that old. I'm not even 40 yet. And so, in that schema, a lot of Latino people were considered pretty much white, or at least white adjacent. But in the 90s, that changed dramatically. I have my ideas why, but I've actually never understood, for example, why the Republican Party couldn't get a handle on this. Because, you know, in other places, Canada is a good example, where the Conservative Party actually has a strong Asian and Latin base. And that's just not true in the United States. So I feel like the racial politics really kind of make the class politics a little bit more nebulous in the U.S. But it's so interesting because I think most people in the United States assume that our understanding of, say, the Latino diaspora is can be retrojected back onto the conditions on the ground in Latin America, except for some ugly anti-communist wars.
Yeah. I mean, it's complex. I mean, the ethnic categories in Latin America are complex because obviously in countries like Brazil, particularly southern Brazil, in Argentina, in Uruguay, and to a less degree Chile, but they had an important immigrations, European immigrations after their independence. So in the case of Brazil, it was they have a huge German population in southern Brazil, so they even spoke a dialect of German there. it's very funny. In Argentina and Uruguay, it was mostly also Italians. In Chile, also Italians, some Germans. So Germans also go to Argentina to less degree Uruguay. So there, the countries of the southern cone always had the more perception that they are more white than the average country, and it's true that still in Argentina you could find indigenous communities, but the view that the generally one half is by the people that live on the capital, and that is sometimes kind of confusing because in Bolivia there is a very curious example that things are different. So Bolivia, like, the capital is La Paz. So La Paz is an Andean city, and the population well, there is an important population that is what we call in Latin America mixed, which is part of European, mostly Spanish descent, and also part of indigenous descent. If one goes to other cities like Santa Cruz, the people are much light-skinned. So there were some parts of the country where were more European immigration. And for example, in the outskirts of Santa Cruz, there is a very important Mennonite community. So the Mennonites are probably the whitest people in Latin America. The most are blondes, and they have a very traditional way of living. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that that is very interesting, because a lot of times when I am seeing the crisis and the border, when they apprehend the kids and things like that, some of the kids have blonde or brown hair. And so it's true that kids generally their hair goes darker, so that's not very strange, but still, it's very complex to put them in an ethnic category. So I think that also sometimes that's used by racists claiming not to be racist, that put the photo of a redhead Mexican and said that we don't oppose immigration because we are racist, but obviously it's true that generally people immigrating illegally don't necessarily are the most white in Latin America, because generally the people of more means are the ones that are mostly of European descent, that either came from colonial families that have money, or more recent immigrants, and particularly Latin America, where there was a lot of people that didn't have education, that live in precarious condition in rural parts of the country. So their emergence have been much slower. And by the contrary, European immigrants flourish in many parts of Latin America. And I guess that's the complexity of ethnic relationships in Latin America.
Well, I think that's, you know, grounded in history too, right? I mean, like the Catholic conception of race relations, even in the La Casta time periods, was, you know, there's 16 to 32 different categories.
Yeah.
You know, the United States tended to have two, maybe four, you know, like WASP, bad whites, people who are probably Caucasian, we're not sure, and everybody else. So, you know, that history is very different. And I find that interplay very fascinating. One of the things I remember when I lived in Mexico, and this is northern Mexico, and so, like, when I lived in northern Mexico, I got mistaken as a local all the time, and I'm pretty, you know, you can see I'm pretty pale. The listeners can't see, but you can see me. Yeah. But, you know, just by dint of having dark hair and a beard sometimes. and so like, people just come up to me and talk to me, you know. One time the pre tried to register me to vote, which was hilarious. Particularly after I told them I was a gringo, and they're like, "We don't care." And I was like, "Oh god." Oh man. That's illegal. I know it's illegal in Mexico. I cannot vote. I do not want to go to Mexican prison. I don't want to go to prison in America either, but still, like, don't really think I'd fare so well there. I don't speak Spanish good enough. But that when I would go to southern Mexico, it was very, very different. Like, and the means were different. You go into the poor areas, you'd see a lot of Mixtec people, a lot of Zapotec people, you know, people whose, you know, Spanish was their third, are not, you know, our fourth language a lot of the times. and often we had to speak through another Spanish-speaking interpreter to translate it into a different language that I had never heard before. So there's this colorism spectrum, right? In America, we know about that, but I don't think we grok it. We tend to assume that people have the same categories of race as us. This even is true in Europe. Like, Europeans and Americans talk about race and they use the same words and they think they're talking about the same thing, but often they're radically not. Like, you tell an American that in the UK, Slavs aren't considered white, and they will stare at you for like an hour. Like, what are you on? And I guess the point I'm only trying to make here is I think a lot of our understanding of Latin America and the racial politics is very naive because we conceive of it in the kind of binary that we have. So where there's a simple category of white and there's a simple category of person of color or and then black, you know, white, brown, black. And things are way more complicated in Latin America and ways very subtle. So Americans can often, you know, Americans and Canadians can often miss it. United Statesians, I'll be better, can often miss the racial dynamics. And I didn't notice it when I first lived in Mexico, and by the second year I really did. So what do you think one of the things about social media and the ubiquity of English, you know, is that you can get a pretty good glimpse into American culture now pretty easily.
Yeah.
Not just Hollywood culture. Like you just go online and American culture kind of dominates the online space. But the reverse is not true. Even though like people are exposed to people from all over the world, those people are approaching them already acculturated to Americans and approaching them like Americans. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Like, what are the most common misunderstandings that you have personally experienced about Latin America? And I'm going to ask you for two groups of people, American libertarians, and then we'll talk about American leftists.
I don't feel like I have really experienced that, but I will say that one thing that people don't understand, for example, Lima, is that even the large cities have kind of indigenous populations.
Mm-hmm.
But the populations are kind of in the outskirts of the city. So the most poor are the neighborhood. The most dark-skinned generally is the person. And also with Afro-Latinos.
Mm-hmm.
So generally they are in the most kind of poor neighborhoods. As you go up to the most affluent neighborhood, you see much more people that could pass as American or actually there have been cases. There was once in the airport in Lima, and I saw a blonde girl and a blonde boy, and they were talking and they seemed like confused, and I was going to talk to them in English, but when I when close, they were speaking in Spanish and they were Argentinians. And so this kind of is very, so it's particular for the also recent immigrants, the expats, as we call them in Latin America, the immigrants that are relatively or upper middle class to upper, generally also go to the affluent neighborhood. So not only that kind of neighborhoods have the kind of white Latin Americans, but they also have to say in some way imported whites. So white Americans, white Canadians, white Europeans generally. So that is kind of the, I think probably you in Mexico City, you could see it also clearly. I mean, it also is related sometimes to music. For example, one of the examples that is more easy to see is to indie rock, for example. Mm-hmm. A lot of the bands of indie rock, of musicians indie rock, doesn't matter the country, you could be Argentina or Bolivia or generally whites, because other music genres like reggaeton are more popular with the much more working class, and indie rock is kind of more, in the US, I guess, even it is more, much more mainstream, but in Latin America is different. So in Latin America, indie rock is much more upper middle class to upper. And in some countries, it's true that it has reached the more mainstream middle class, but in some degrees, it's kind of different than in the U.S. And it's very curious that kind of musical difference also.
Yeah, that's kind of fascinating. Because in the United States, those differences were pretty clear in the past, but they have kind of devolved over time. So, like, you see, it's not as odd to see African-Americans play country music, for example. You know, and I mean, this is a little different. You know, in northern Mexico, where I lived, like, all music kind of sounded like country with an accordion, because even like the corrados, you know, the like really aggressive narco ballads and stuff were in that. And then like upper middle class, mostly kind of whitish people listen to indie rock, and then everybody kind of listened to heavy metal, which was interesting. But, you know, just to do a little bit of amateur ethnography, but that, you know, that stuff is, those cultural signifiers are telling, and they're interesting when they fall away. You know, I guess it makes sense, too, that, like, if you're from a European background, you have more access to the market, historically speaking, and thus, like, these kind of exotic, highly niche, you know, cultural movements are also, they're also really highly niche products, right? And they develop kind of time and cultivation to get into, and it just wouldn't be immediately accessible in all other communities.
Yeah, I could put a very curious example. For example, there is a Brazilian indie rock band which is called Can Say the Ser Sexy, and they have go to several countries. They have go to the US and they have even go 3 times to New Zealand, but they didn't have go to Peru. So it's kind of very curious because they are Latin American, but they prefer to play in more white places. And well, they are white except the singer, which is Japanese. So Japanese are very curious category because in Latin America, Japanese are generally also to upper middle class to upper. So they have prospered a lot in Latin America. And in Brazil and Peru, there is kind of an important Japanese community.
So outside of colorism, what I experienced in Mexico, like the only acceptable ethno-prejudice that I remember was common was anti-Chinese. I mean, it was common enough that I literally got 2 papers by kids who wrote to me about how, you know, hating Chinese people was okay. And it had a very similar flavor to hating Jews in Europe, like, you know, these is a minority, they're super prosperous, they come and take our jobs and work in banking, et cetera, and so forth. But I think that may be uniquely, like, kind of upper Central American because it's tied into the railroad and these other specific historical conditions. Is there anything like that that people misunderstand in you know, the upper parts of South America?
I think that's more a Mexican thing because in Peru, particularly, has a very large Chinese community. So basically, everyone has some person that we call the Chinese aunt or Chinese uncle. So we are related to some people to some degree to someone Chinese. It's much difficult to be anti-Chinese or a Chinese hater to some degree. I mean, it's much difficult here.
So one of the concepts that I remember of Mexico that was interesting because it blew most Americans' minds was the cosmic race idea. So the whole, like, we're not going to abandon race. We're going to make it all inclusive. So, you know, we're awesome Latino people and we marry everybody and bring everybody into this cosmic race where we're all kind of, you know, different shades of Mexican. But when you threw that idea at Americans, they're just like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, like, but it makes certain things very interesting. You know, so for example, when you hear like Chicanos talk about La Raza, you're never quite sure if they think of Latino as a race or if they're talking about that cosmic race idea. And you usually have to ask and, you know, you'd have to know to ask. I actually don't know if that's just a Mexican thing or not.
That's a good question. I think that, for example, in Peru, there was always an attempt to attract European immigration in the 19th century and in the early part of the 20th century. And they weren't that successful. So there is a small Italian community and a smaller, even much smaller German community, but and other immigrants from Europe, but there are really small communities, you know, and some of them basically have disappeared as communities and become part of the mainstream society to some degree. But yeah, I mean, there were attempts, like, and that attempts were kind of, the broad political spectrum was kind of okay with that. And it was probably only the anarchists wasn't that they were an anti-immigrant, but it's kind of they kind of reivindicated the indigenous people more than even the socialist left, at least early the socialist left, in the kind of regards toward the importance of diversity. Yeah, I mean, it's It's curious. I mean, what Trump says about Haitians being from a shithole country, and then he says that he wants Norwegians. I'm sure also is something that has some relevance, because actually Dominican Republic expel a lot of Haitians, people from Haiti. And that's something that didn't get much coverage. So it's very curious, because the average Dominican is in part of to some degree of African descent, with the exception of a very probably a tiny fraction that the more recent immigrants. But most of them are at least partially of African descent. And despite that, they expel the population from Haiti. And it's very curious, but it's... I think that it was because, despite them being from African descent, at least partially, the people from Haiti were mostly 100% of African descent. So they look kind of different and they look much darker. So I guess they were able to make a difference, and that difference became important. And then they actually not only expelled the ones that were kind of illegally, but also they expelled even the kids that were born in Dominican Republic, allegedly that their parents have entered illegally. It was kind of, it didn't cause as much aurora as we'll think it will get. But even in Peru, like when people from Haiti came to the north, they were trying to move to Brazil, really. But the newspapers in the north tried to say that it was kind of invasion, and they actually expelled them. So it also happened that. And with Venezuelans, it's kind of a mixed issue, because Venezuela is a very... So that is a very curious issue. So Venezuela has less indigenous population, but has more Afro-Latino population, and at the same time has a larger white population. So it's kind of a mix. It's kind of a mixed population in many ways, much more mixed in some ways than the lower Latin American populations. And I think that it has to do some of the attitudes that have been kind of xenophobic in Peru and other countries of Latin America. Had also had to deal that the more poor Venezuelans tend to be much more either Afro-Latino or dark skin as Venezuelans, and that the white Venezuelans the generally they have money, they speak English or even other language, so they rather than move to Peru or Chile, they have moved to Germany or the U.S. So the immigrants that have come to other countries in Latin America, they have tended to be the more kind of working class Venezuelans rather than the more affluent that have gone to other places.
So I wanted to talk to you about Venezuela. I know that you're not a specialist, but in the United States, there's kind of three camps. There's the U.S. should leave Venezuela the hell alone, but maybe not talk about how awesome Maduro is, camp, which is what I'm in. You don't have to like Maduro to think that the U.S. should leave them the hell alone. Yeah. There is the Maduro did nothing wrong camp.
Yeah.
And there is the Maduro did everything wrong. He's bad. Also, Chavez was bad. Also, anti-imperial socialism ends up just being nationalism, so suck it camp. This is on the left, and then there's obviously the normal, like, you know, Red Scare tendencies. But I have found, talking to Venezuelans, that no narrative in the United States seems to be suitably complicated for what's going on. It does seem like, one, there's racial issues that we don't understand, that you kind of brought up here, but there are... that, like, there isn't a strong indigenous population, which I believe I knew. But there was a lot of Afro-Latinos and a lot more mixed-race people, and Venezuela was more strongly settler-colonial in a very real way. More like the United States in that sense, where there just aren't a lot of indigenous people left, and the racial issues are among different groups of immigrants. Are people who weren't really immigrants but slaves but aren't originally from the area. And then, to make it worse, though, there's a lot of denial that things are as bad as they are blaming it solely on U.S. policy. Now, I tend to think that this is just false. You know, I'm not an anti-Chavista, but I, even back in the days where things were looking good, I was worried about them basing all their social policies off of oil markets because it seemed dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, to talk about to start talking about the racial issues, I mean, one of the things that is more relevant, I guess, of Guaido is that he is not white as other leaders of the Venezuelan opposition. So the Venezuelan opposition, like some of his leaders, have been the most right-ward people that there is. And while the right in Venezuela used to be powerful, the most right-ward weren't as powerful. So, and I guess that Guaido is kind of more, in some ways, close to the understanding that, that Venezuela is more than just the rich white people. And he has mentioned that the bad treatment of indigenous population, because even if it's smaller than indigenous population than Peru or Bolivia, it still has a presence, and it hasn't had also that good relationship with Maduro. So I guess, yes, that the racial issues play an important role. I also will say that there is kind of elements that are really interesting in many ways that I think that, yes, I mean, Venezuela bet all in oil, and it was a complex bet, and it basically lose. And I think, obviously, there has been corruption and many other problems that are not unique of Venezuela, but there have been complicated in a very dramatic way. Even Bolivia, which is a country which much less resources, is trying to diversificate their income, not just from mining or from gas, but also from other issues and projects. So, I mean, it wasn't one doing it to be a genius to predict that if the market weren't right for oil, the problems will appear. But it happened exactly in the worst way possible. And I think that the death of Chavez play a role in Maduro having a more hard hand between him and the population, but also the coup attempt. Many say that the coup attempt that Chavez suffered made him go rightward. But more authoritarian in some ways. And I guess that's true. I mean, because now many in the Venezuelan opposition talk about the constitution of that Maduro that Chavez enacted, so it can sound weird, but Chavez reached power not as a revolutionary socialist, but as a more patriotic nationalist. So it was in office that he was kind of shifting ideologically toward the ideas of Bolivarian socialism.
Do you have any real sense of the popular support that the Maduro government still has? I mean, in the United States, there's a narrative that it's lost it and has for a while, and the last election was probably illegitimate. But I know that for at least during the Chavez regime and the first part of Maduro's regime, even early on there were signs of problems, that he really did have pretty broad-based popular support, particularly amongst the poorer elements of Venezuelan society, with the exception of some issues with the indigenous, which have been underreported dramatically in the U.S. left, because it complicates the narrative, right? But now I have a hard time. I read a variety of different sources, but every source in the United States, or that you read in English, even left-wing sources or sources that are translated from other countries like China, are biased. And I do have enough grasp of Spanish to read like Mexican reporting on Venezuela, but that also seems biased. So I actually have no idea what the popular mood is. Does anyone, I guess?
It's difficult to say, but when there have been videos of the speeches that Maduro gives, you see that there are still people there. So I think that he still has popular support. The question is how many, and if in what regards that could block an attempt of coup. I think that Guaido thought that he was going to have a much larger support from the military, and he hasn't had it. Probably there's also playing that there have been arrests previous of the Guaido entering power, that probably the people that have been detained were people that were kind of thinking on rebelling against Maduro. So there is probably something of that. I think that it's very difficult to say the situation. And the government of Colombia, even if it's right-wing, is mixed about its feelings about an American intervention, because probably an American intervention will lead to a much larger immigration from Venezuela. And they already have 1 million Venezuelans. And it's difficult because it's difficult for them to get a job. And it's also difficult, the ones that don't have a job, to maintain them. So it's very complex. And when the day of the attempt of Guaido of calling for a rebellion, even someone, a security advisor to Bolsonaro, even the same day tweeted that his sources say that Guaido was not going to be successful, that people should move on. So it's very curious, because I really don't know what Bolsonaro's effect is going to have on that, because he's much rightward than the current president of Colombia, Duque. But at the same time, it's true that a coup in Venezuela is probably what he wants. It's going to create a very complicated picture in South America, particularly northern part of South America. And yeah, it's difficult to say what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea either. The military to me is the great unknown, because I will give Chavez and Maduro both a lesson that they've learned from all the people in the 70s who didn't take getting the military on board seriously. You know, they're all dead now. But it does seem like if the inflation and food shortages continue, I don't know how long the military can hold out. But then again, I thought that for North Korea for a long time too, and obviously it still exists. And similarly, you know, it has its apologists in the United States, but I'm honestly at a loss for what a leftist would even want out of a place. With Venezuela, it's a little bit clearer. You'd want, I don't know, something more like a more democratically legitimate Maduro, maybe. But even if he is democratically legitimate, with some concessions. But in a place like North Korea, what you would even like, what the alternative is, even clear. And I guess I bring this up, you know, you deal with a lot of American leftists online, maybe not a lot, but a few. How do you find their understanding of geopolitics? And be honest.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that seemed to me curious was the when the DSA make their convention, their main convention after Trump, and that they have representatives from Europe, but not from Latin America, was kind of curious. I think that it's very curious that I don't think that the American left wants to reach out to the Latin American left to a certain degree. I know that there are, for example, I know that there are some tendencies in left communism growing in some parts of the U.S., which are kind of curious, but in Latin America, there is not the equivalent. But I think in other tendencies, you find much more common ground. Even I'm surprised that Trotskyists, of all people, don't have that much links with the Latin American Trotskyists. I know that Latin American Trotskyists are a very broad movement, and yes, Posadistas are Trotskyists, but I think they are most meme these days. I mean, I'm surprised by the lack of knowledge that many American leftists have of the Latin American left, and it's not that there aren't things in English. So the ones that don't speak Spanish or Portuguese still can get some things published that are written in English. Ones there.
I remember a lot of cheerleading about the pink wave, but no one really trying to understand it, just saying it was good when all the socialists of the rest of the planet seemed to be getting their asses handed to them. And I remember thinking, like, I don't think it's going to be that simple. There seems to be a lot of things screwing up. the exception that I have noticed is there is a section of the DSA that is totally obsessed with Lula. And for good reason, I'm not, you know, but still, like, but that seems to be the extent of the understanding. Like, the history of the parties and all that seems to be largely lost. It's like, we know the Workers' Party in Brazil, and we know a little bit about Obrador in Mexico, and that's about it. And Bolivia. But we don't know anything about Bolivia. We just know that, you know, that dude's cool.
I was just talking with last year I was talking with a Brazilian libertarian. We were saying that Brazil is kind of the other, it's very different than the rest of Latin America. In many ways, it's much similar to the U.S. For example, there are incels, there are furries that in other parts of Latin America there aren't. And so these small groups. And also there are the libertarians, there are really a large movement in other parts of Latin America. Here in Peru, like the main organization of libertarians in our country, which is Students for Liberty, doesn't even exist anymore. So, by difference in Brazil, they are pretty active. And I think that in that way, I understand the interest in Brazil that there is. And I think that it's very curious, but I think that Bolsonaro is based on many ideas of the American right, even if fusionism is dying in the U.S. I think he is fusionism in Brazil. I think there are strong criticisms from the left to Lula and to the Workers' Party that they should have do more to include the social movements, I still that think that for now they are going to be the main rival to Bolsonaro. So it's going to be a difficult moment for the left, because I know that some will have preferred that other organization will come up, but I think that they will kind of be the kind of representatives more of that kind of resistance against Bolsonaro. In the case of Mexico, I think that it's very interesting because he excited a lot of part of the Latin American left, but I wouldn't say he's conceding to Trump, but I think that part of the success of López Obrador has to do with Trump, and I think that Trump is consolidating his support. So he's not necessarily an anti-Trump, but I think that López Obrador has a much more nationalist position. So now the opposition parties on the center and the right are criticizing López Obrador for the deal with Mexico, but it's impossible to think that they wouldn't have signed it if they were in government. So, and being they, probably they will have signed it much quicker because they think free trade is much more important. So,
well, I mean, Vicente Fox's party, for example, in America, he's read as kind of like a, you know, a left of centrist. And I'm like, Vicente Fox and Calderon were rightist, not like hard rightist, but they were rightist. And kind of rightist that were allowed, that like the priest sort of allowed to get legitimacy. And I think, I mean, one of the things about that people in the United States don't get is the kind of degeneration of the pre. And then, Fox's and Calderon's movements to deal with the cartels under American guidance, which went utterly terrible. But the pre actually didn't get that much done either, despite, you know, a willingness to play the corruption game a little bit more. So I agree. I think I agree with your analysis. The only thing I would say that complicates it is that I do think the Mexican public was crying out for somebody to sort of try to find another way to handle the cartelization problem. Because if it wasn't for America's drug demand, frankly, Mexico would be a model, you know, developing country right now. I mean, it's got a pretty strong economy internally. I mean, and Americans don't realize that, but I mean, except for the very poor parts of the South, like Chiapas and Oaxaca and parts of the Yucatan, it's like there, you can be in certain places and Mexico now, and you would be hard pressed to tell the difference if you were in somewhere in the Southwest of the States. Monterrey comes to mind. So.
Yeah, Monterrey.
I just think, like, Americans just don't understand it, which is kind of strange, given how many, even how many Americans lived there.
Yeah, that's funny. But yeah, I think that you're right. I mean, yeah, the handle of the drug war was terrible. I mean, and Fox and Calderon just make the things even worse. I mean, you were mentioning Monterrey. Monterrey used to be known as a very quiet city. I mean, it's quiet in the sense that it wasn't dangerous as other parts of Mexico. And the issue with the cartels is that they end up with the drug war intensified, they end up shooting inside of shopping malls, something that in Latin America is very strange. I mean, they have been shoots outside shopping malls, but not inside. So that was kind of a very kind of dramatic point in the drug war. And the funny thing is that in Mexico City, as far as I know, the security increased a lot. So the government was really preoccupied that there were going to be major attacks from the cartels in Mexico City. And since it was Mexico City and the majority of the foreign press was there, so they were worried that would give a bad image. There still were kidnappings and murders, but not as major as in other parts of Mexico, where there is much more dangerous.
With the exception of Michoacán, which is kind of ground zero, the closer you get to the United States, the further you are from God, as they say in Spanish. I mean, the funny thing is Americans think Mexico City, they have an image of Mexico City from like the 80s and 90s. And when I'm in Mexico City, I'm like, this place is great.
You know? Yeah, it's pretty cool.
it's really developed. It's safe. I mean, unless you're in like the rancheros on the edge of the city, it's really pretty safe. Someone might take $20 from you if you're in the wrong part of town. But I mean, like, you know, that's true anywhere.
So. Yeah, that could happen. I know people that have been involved in Oregon, like, so yeah, that happened everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, Torreon was similar to Monterrey. Torreon was actually one of the safest places in Mexico, and when I lived there, it's gotten safer again because frankly, El Chapo won the war with the Zetas. But when I lived there, it was like the seventh most dangerous city in the world.
Oh my god!
Yeah. Like, it was crazy. I guess the last thing that we might want to talk about, this is more Central America, not South America, and I want to make sure my listeners stay up on the differences, because I'm never quite sure how educated they really are on this. But one of the things about the current refugee crisis, and there is a real refugee crisis, like there were larger numbers of people going to the States in the 80s and 90s, but they were all men. You know, and they were largely seeking work to send remittances home. Now you have a lot of women and children running, and that's new. But one of the things about that is, yes, Honduras and to a lesser degree El Salvador are kind of quasi-failed states. Nicaragua, too, I guess, to some degree. Failed states may be too strong of a word, but things are pretty bad there. But there is no talk about the relationship of the U.S. drug war to why it is that bad. Or very little of it.
I mean, in the Spanish language press, basically, there is no talk about it. That's quite sad. I think that in the reasons, I guess that vary depends on the country. I think in Guatemala, it has to do with the climate change. I think it's affecting them more than in other parts of Central America. In Honduras and El Salvador, it has to do, yes, with violence. They are escaping the gangs, but also with work, because if you hear the people speak in the interviews that they do, many say they want to find work because they don't find it. So, yeah, that's kind of the main reasons why they are leaving, and that's true. So they are not. They don't see a future for them in Central America. That's why they are trying to reach to the U.S. So that's why they're going families, complete families, basically. And that's the difference between now and other eras of immigration. But because, as you said, they were going to send money home, but now is they just want they, there is no home from them in their own country, so they want to start all over again in the U.S.
I mean, and in some way, what you know, I have not heard. I mean, of course I wouldn't, right? But I haven't even heard the anti, you know, even the anti-immigration left, which there is some. Not a lot. It's a very minority position, but there is some. Talk about the relationship of the drug war to all this and to U.S., you know, U.S. developmental patterns. And, I mean, people kind of know it on abstract, but it hasn't really been dealt with thoroughly. And, I mean, interestingly enough, that was true in South America in the past. Although, you know, Americans, when they think of Colombia, they think it's still like Pablo Escobar land from the 70s. which is funny. And I'm like, no, it's kind of a safe place where they eat a lot of mayonnaise. I bet you didn't know that, but yeah. you know, mayonnaise chips and coffee. But it's, I mean, you know, Colombia is a pretty stable place now. I have a lot of friends that live there, both expats and local. But it followed a similar trend. And a lot of the upper part, you know, the non-southern cone part of South America did. What do you think changed the developmental patterns there? Like, was it related to Venezuela? Was there other things going on? What do you think happened?
It's interesting to know. I mean, Colombia was already it has more resources than other countries, like, say, Paraguay. I mean, but even Paraguay is getting better, their economy, but that's another story. I guess that in Central America, the main difference is that the governments are much more corrupt. In Colombia, the war against the guerrillas was very difficult, but it also played in the development of the state, of the Colombian state. So the Colombian state is more larger, bigger, and stronger than other Latin American states, where they're weaker. And their main function is collect taxes, but they don't even provide for the services because there's a lot of corruption. So in Colombia, there's corruption, but the state is larger. So it provides some more services than other countries. And it has grown to a much more degree than in other places. By the nature of the gangs in Central America, the kind of fight doesn't necessarily have make the state stronger. But as far as I know, for example, in Honduras, the situation with the gangs have been slowly becoming less dangerous, even if it's still a little bit. But the problem in Honduras is that the government has moved rightward and is cutting social services. So I guess that to some degree they are trying to escape in Honduras. In the case of Nicaragua, is interesting because in Nicaragua they are not trying to reach the U.S. They are trying to reach Costa Rica. So there is a very different kind of problem that sometimes doesn't get that much coverage because there is not that large amount of Nicaraguans in the U.S. In El Salvador, Guatemala is more a combination of problems, I think. And it's going to be interesting what the things could happen in the near future. I think that Guatemala is going to be much difficult because, as I have told you, the problems with the climate change are going to affect them in a more hard way than in other parts of Central America. So it's going to be very difficult. And that is a very interesting kind of seeing what is going to happen there.
Is there anything you'd like to say in closing? We've been all over the place tonight, but I think this is kind of a good introduction to the basic understanding of Latin America, and I'll probably have you back on to talk about more specific things in the future.
Yeah, there is a lot of talk about Latin America. I think it's a very curious place. There is a lot of weird stories, and it's very funny because I see that the Latin American left, that the American left puts a lot of the story about the Posadistas, but... in Peru, there was a group that still exists. They combine Christianism with ufology, with UFO religion, and they are leftists, and they go to the protests, and and they're pretty left wing. They are very weird. Yeah, it's I mean, there you find very strange things in Latin America, not just positives. You find groups all over the ideological place. I mean, it's a pretty interesting place to see politics.
My favorite thing that freak people out is when I tell people about my several encounters with Mexican neo-Nazis, which confused the hell out of people. They're like, I'm like, yeah, there's this Sonoran front thing. I was just like, and they were pretty mestizo too. I was confused myself. But
yeah, in Brazil, there are much more Nazis. I mean, as far as I know, in Brazil, there are much more.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, everyone thinks there's a bunch of Nazis in Argentina because I guess there was a bunch of actual German ones hanging out there. But, yeah. But I mean, you know, the world is weird, and Latin America is a very – I think the other thing about – when we talk about Latin America, it is – the only thing a lot of it shares is that most of it, not even all of it, and I'm not even just talking about Brazil, speaks Spanish. Although my favorite outliers are like people forget that Belize speaks English and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But culturally, I mean, and a lot of it's Catholic, but culturally it's actually really, really different from place to place, and politically too, I think.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the parts of the South that are closer to Bolivia are much more left-wing, for example, in Peru. Yeah, that's true. Even from country to country, it kind of... It's diverse politically.
Yeah,
there are some parties that develop strengths even in particular cities. So it's very curious the kind of political alliances that there are in parts of Latin America.
Oh yeah, I mean, I remember like being in Oaxaca and meeting like large numbers of Marxist-Leninists in Oaxaca City, and then large numbers of anarchists, and I'd be like, this is interesting. And like they would be highly involved with like the teachers union, you know, and stuff like that. And I mean, and there are also like traditional holdovers that Americans just do not understand. Like one of the issues that when Americans generally supported the teacher strikes in Latin and Mexico, but they didn't understand this whole like inheriting your classroom to your kid thing.
Yeah.
And they were like, when I explained that to people, they're like, that's one of the, like, that's absurd. I'm like, yeah, but it's kind of a medieval holdover that's still part of the culture. And yeah, I don't think people really get the area. And so there are more people than Posadists out there on the weird spectrum. Trotskyists in general in Latin America tend to be more interesting than in the Anglo world. And interesting's in quotation marks. You know, so yeah. All right. Well, take care, Camilo, and we'll talk again in the future.
Take care, you too. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, it was fun. Thank you.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever-faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day. Thank you.